Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
So given your background as a security specialist and somebody who served our country for many years, you've practiced security affairs for many years, what can you say if we just begin by thinking about some of the most important security concerns we face today? You've mentioned before, for example, that we've built this national security state in the United States. What do you mean by that, and what are those specific concerns that we're really facing?
By national security state, I take my education, if you will, from Michael Hogan. He wrote a book called A Cross of Iron, and that, of course, is a passage from Eisenhower.
This world in arms is not spending money alone.
And in that speech, Eisenhower talks about the cost of a single bomber.
We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat.
Or the cost of a ship.
We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people.
And then he says at the end of his remarks, or at least at the end of this segment, he says,
this is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
That's what a national security state is. It's a state that devotes so much of its revenues to the military instrument, to security in general, that it really begins to impact the amount of revenue you have to devote to what our founders would call life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It becomes not a state aimed at the betterment of the people and the raising of their standard of living and the freer enterprise that constitutes, but a state that's more interested in its own security than anything else. It's a wonderful manifestation, or a sad manifestation, of what Benjamin Franklin allegedly said when he said, people who will give up their liberty for security deserve neither. Well, essentially, ever since the end of the Cold War, arguably building all during the Cold War, we've been experimenting with this concept of giving up our liberty for our security. It's no longer give me liberty or give me death. It's give me my security at any cost, including my liberty.
So does that mean then that it's the enormous amount of money we're committing to this enterprise that then drives what our security interests are and our security concerns are, and the fact that we are implementing or we're facing these challenges of all sorts today with our military, like crime or drug trafficking, immigration, other kinds of issues that may be peripheral to the real strategic interests of the state?
I think you're right in the sense that it does have a direct impact on some of those things, and even an indirect impact on almost all of them. Whether you're talking about the so-called drug war, which the military has been heavily involved in since 1988, which in effect is murdering or imprisoning a good percentage of our population, to moving into the whole realm of how easy it is for the president to launch wars now. When war becomes something that you do routinely, you need to examine the very fabric of your republic. Recently, the House conducted a hearing that's titled was something like, Have We Militarized Our Foreign Policy? Welcome to the real world, House of Representatives. This has been going on for some time. If you give the military the predominant share of the federal budget, they're going to be the most powerful entity in that budget. And you say, well, that's the way it should be because I want my security. Well, you better start examining what really gives you your security. I would argue the first thing that gives us our security is our liberty. That's the essence of our security. The second thing is our economic power. You do not build ships, planes, tanks, or any other paraphernalia of war without a very strong, robust economic base. We do not have a very strong, robust economic base right now. So in many ways, you're right. This militarization of foreign policy and of life really affects the whole republic.
But there's a connection here, right? I mean, you're kind of alluding to this larger connection of large military budget, large defense budget, and private industry and the military-industrial complex on the one hand. But just it's even broader than that, really.
It's now the military-industrial terrorist complex.
Okay, so what do you mean by that exactly? So I mean, because you know, you've commented about this connection between power and money in American politics in general, but particularly on the issue of security and defense. What do you mean by that statement?
If you look at what we've done in the last 10 years, fiscal year 2007, for example, was higher security spending than any year of the Cold War. And then you back up and you say, why? During the Cold War, we were faced with an existential threat. We could have had our way of life eliminated in several hours. We don't face any such threat today. Indeed, if you combine all the casualties of terrorism in our history, colonial and national, you will not find as many deaths as we kill on the highways of America in automobile accidents in an annual period. So why is it that we're spending all this money, creating all this fear, expanding the security complex? Let me give you an example of that. And Dana Priest and Bill Arkin in the Washington Post have highlighted this dramatically. When I was given my top secret security clearance some years ago, there were perhaps 30, 35,000 people who joined me in those ranks. There are 840,000 plus now. That's just a graphic example of the expansion of the security complex. And these people are doing everything from reading your emails to surveilling you at times you don't even know you're under surveillance to determining whether or not you as an American citizen are associated with terrorism sufficiently to kill you with a Predator drone or a Reaper drone somewhere. So this is a real change, and it's mostly due to this inordinate fear we have caused principally by 9/11. I don't understand it. I simply don't understand why it is more dangerous to live today and therefore we need to spend much more money on the security instrument than it was when we were truly threatened by the Soviet Union.
So an overreaction.
Yes, and an overreaction exploited by everyone from the defense contractors to our congressmen who are heavily indebted to those defense contractors, who are heavily indebted to them not just for PAC money, political action committee money, and political money in general, but also for jobs. You take my state of Virginia, for example. If you want to get both of my senators and all of my representatives up in arms, start talking about closing down facilities in Norfolk, where the greatest probably shipyard facilities are in the United States. That'll get them all going, Democrat and Republican alike. And I don't blame them, but at the same time, I say we need a longer vision.
But how are we to back away from this now? I mean, once there is, for lack of a better term, let's say that gravy train of defense contracting, I mean, it's been going on for since 9/11, but certainly before that as well. How do we get off? How do we stop the gravy train? I mean, what do we do?
The first thing, Eisenhower said it so eloquently in his farewell address in January 1961.
Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
And we don't have an alert citizenry. Only citizens who really care about this and who understand that just out of the Pentagon, you could take $50 billion in FY 2013, which only has a few months left, and you would only increase the efficiency and effectiveness of the armed forces of the United States. It's doable. You don't want to do it by automatic cuts, so-called sequestration, because that's stupid. That's clumsy. But you want to do it wisely. One of the things you could do, for example, and this is just one example, I could probably run through 100. We had something like 12 to 16 million men and women, civilian and military, under arms, so to speak, in World War II. We had fewer flag and general officers then than we do now. Wow. Let's get to cutting some of those people. There are other examples that are just as glaring and perhaps even more money-saving in the long run, and they involve, to a large extent, what we're doing with people now. People are anywhere from 50 to 60%, depending on whose records and analysis you look at, of the DOD budget. They're so expensive, health care. When I came into the Army, for example, maybe 12, 15% of my people around me were married and had kids. Now it's something like 60, 70%. Well, they're all on the health care bill, and the health care bill is skyrocketing. So we have to do something not just about health care nationally to bring costs down, but we also have to do it security-wise because our armed forces are going to outprice our ability to pay for them if we don't.
So, but let's connect this to one of the other issues, the recent announcement that women can now serve in open combat. Now, we know that women have really been kind of on the front lines for a while, right? Because there really aren't defined clear front lines in today's contemporary wars. So we've lost women in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so this is perhaps a decision that was made after, after the fact.
Right.
But what is it? Is there something else going on there in terms of making this decision now that has to do with, as you've been talking about, recruitment and getting people into the military, if it's going to be a volunteer force with benefits in order to attract them in?
Absolutely, there's something else going on. Women make the best soldiers. Women are less subject to judicial and non-judicial punishment. They don't go absent without leave. They're less promiscuous. They don't start barroom brawls and so forth and so on. Best soldier, using those metrics, is a woman. Right now, this has no egalitarian spirit connected with it. It's because we can't recruit sufficient good soldiers and Marines. And so we're going to open everything up possible to women because we can recruit. Statistics, at least so far, show we can recruit women. So this is a real utilitarian goal, not a pie in the sky goal to let women be totally equal. And it's got another dimension, too, that's really scary, really scary. We know now from studies that have been done, and this is going to break probably on a number of different TV shows in the next 6 months, that probably a third of the females in the military, particularly the Army and the Air Force, but particularly Army and Marine Corps, but also the Air Force, and to a certain extent in the Navy, suffer some kind of sexual assault in a 3 to 6 year tour. Many of them suffer rape, and there's been absolutely no control of this or diminishment of it from the leadership in the Pentagon or in the uniformed services. So I think this is also a part of their saying, if we just put women into an equal position to men, this sexual assault business will change.
Do you think that'll work?
I think that's nonsense. I think it's absolute nonsense. Sexual assault does not occur because she's your equal or not your equal. When you're in a foxhole and you've got that bond of combat, which is the thing that holds squads together in the ground forces in particular, not mom and apple pie and patriotism. It's the bond you feel for your fellow soldier. And you destroy that bond by raping either a male. The rape rate for males is fairly high. It's about 11%. You destroy that bond, utterly destroy it. And it's talking about making them equal in the foxhole, they're already equal. Ever been in a foxhole? They're already equal. So this is a really specious attempt to cure that problem too, a problem they've been unable to deal with. And you've got an ingrained culture that doesn't want to deal with it, wants to shove it under the rug. So there's a lot behind this opening all ranks and all combat MOSs to women that doesn't meet the American public's eye. They simply don't know about.
So those who then criticize this decision to openly allow women to openly serve in combat positions, there's been that criticism that this is going to be a detriment to our security rather than enhance our security in general. Would that be the position, or is it clearly something that has to do with the leadership here and not just including women in combat?
I don't subscribe to that argument as long as – and my daughter was an Army officer. She got her education at Georgetown through a ROTC scholarship. My daughter was able to do push-ups with any man, run with any man. She beat most of the men. If they don't relax standards, then women will enter the combat arms in limited numbers because you've got to have a probably generational change if you're going to get the biological and physiological component of the kind of strength it takes alone to tote a 180-pound man who's wounded 100 meters across the battlefield. Not that some women can't do that already. My daughter, one of them. But it's going to be limited at first. So what's going to happen? I've been there. I've done this. What happens is you lower standards. You lower standards in order to make the political goal of having more women in this rank or that rank. And so that is probably a danger to the armed forces and their ability to carry out their mission. But that's a failure of leadership. Again, my daughter and I had this discussion at my granddaughter's soccer game the other day. As long as they don't relax the standards, as long as they only take women like me who are capable of beating men at their own task, that's wonderful. But and this is my daughter talking. If they lower the standards, shame on them.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, this has definitely given us something to think about. Thank you very much for joining us today on World Peace.
Thanks for having me.